Today, how County Line's drug gangs are changing their tactics, and an opinion, Owen Jones, on why Remainers should welcome Labour's new Brexit policy. Last year, a 16-year-old boy from North London got in a car with people he didn't know and no idea where they were going to take him. He owed a drug dealer £55, and with no way to pay him back, he'd agreed to work with him. Now he was being driven hundreds of miles away to Bodmin in Cornwall, where he would be forced to sell drugs from a cramped flat to local addicts. At night, he slept on a chair. It didn't take police long to track him down. When they raided the flat, they found drugs with a street value of over £1,200, and the boy was taken away to a safe place. These are details that emerged early this month in the trial of seven members of a County Lines gang. And the story, sadly, is pretty typical, and it's one we're hearing again and again across the country.
Devon's News at 5, I'm Alison Johns. A gang who used runaway teenagers to run a massive County Lines drug dealing operation has been jailed for a total of 34 years.
Police in North Wales, Merseyside and Scotland.
Two people have been found guilty of conspiracy to supply Class A drugs.
County Lines gangs traffic drugs from cities to small towns, often using children as young as seven to do it. They use dedicated phone lines to sell, and it's estimated there are over 2,000 of these across the country. But as the police become more aware of how these gangs operate, some of them are professionalising, developing their tactics to avoid detection and grooming children in a way that is making it almost impossible for many of them to escape. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the evolution of County Lines drug gangs. Does an operation, like a County Lines operation, how does that begin? So say we've got a drug dealer in London and they want to expand to perhaps a town on the south coast. What would they need to do to begin that process?
So first, they really need to get their customers. They would need to figure out who the addicts are in the area.
Amna Modin is a news reporter for The Guardian.
And sometimes that means just going to the local area, going to the town centre and seeing who the homeless people are, who are the obvious addicts in that area. Sometimes they'll bully or exploit really vulnerable addicts, get them to open up their homes to them. And then that's when they've got their base. That's really, really important. And that process is called a cuckooing. They have one place that they can go back to constantly and it's their hub.
I've seen interviews of people who've been the victims of cuckooing, and it's horrific.
There's a knock on my door, like 7 o'clock at night, and I always look for my spy hole before I enter the door, and I looked, and there was a group of lads. I don't know why I opened my door, right, but I did, and so I opened it. And there's a barge pass straight into my living room. Just loads of, we'll give you this, we'll give you that, let us stay here. I had no choice really in the matter. And I had to go into my bedroom. And then I was in my bedroom for 2 days. The only place I was allowed to go was my toilet.
It's really horrible, really, really violent a lot of the times. And that vulnerable person feels like they can't go to the police because they're addicts and they're using the drugs. So they feel really quite complicit in the operation. So it's really quite smart in the way that they do it. Once they've got their base, they need to get runners.
So runners are the people who move the drugs from urban areas to these rural areas or seaside towns. And as you mentioned, they're often kids, could be 15, 16. But we've read reports that they can even be as young as seven. How are these gangs recruiting these children?
A place where children are often recruited from are pupil referral units or PRUs. This is where a young person is sent if they've been excluded from mainstream education, and it really ranges the kind of education they get. Some people are there in what's known as twilight hours, so they're there just for 2 hours, and that works quite well for drug dealers, so a lot of them are hanging around outside of PRUs trying to lure them in. One common narrative that we came across was a kid will be coming out of school, then going to a chicken shop, and then an older gang member would start buying them food. And they would think, oh, this is amazing. We've got this, you know, this really cool guy is buying us all food. He's got really amazing stuff. And then within a matter of weeks, that guy, that gang member will turn around and say, well, you owe me £50. And it freaks that kid out. You know, if they're 14-year-old, that's not the kind of money that they have on them. And then the guy says, you know, no worries at all. I have a really easy way for you to make up that money. We would need you to go down to, you know, Margate, take this drugs with you, and then give it to the person that's waiting for you in Margate, or sell it to whoever comes to that house. It's a good cop, bad cop kind of arrangement. So they initially are really friendly, really warm. A lot of times they're this kind of father figure, or, you know, an older brother figure that people are really craving, and they give them a sense of purpose, a sense of self, and then it gets really ugly very quickly.
Wow. Are there incidents within this network of sexual exploitation of children?
Oh, definitely. So the chicken shop is kind of how a lot of young boys are groomed into it. It's slightly different with girls. A lot of the time, vulnerable girls are targeted by men who want to create the impression of really loving romantic relationships, and people are much more aware of child sexual exploitation, and that's when, yeah, they end up getting in these relationships with 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and then they use them to move large amounts of drugs.
When a child is brought into this and they, say, get on a train and go to the seaside town, they're taken to the house that has been taken over. What happens when they get there? What would a day for them look like in this industry as it is?
What is quite common is the person who owns the house or who kind of rents it goes into their own room, and a lot of the times they're there doing drugs, and the young person is there in the living room or some forward facing part of the house, and people come in throughout the day buying drugs, and the young person, yeah, sells it to them, puts the money in a certain place, and they do that in really long shifts, you know, 10 to 12 hours. Sometimes at the end of the shift, once they go home, they are giving some cash, but a lot of times they're working off this quite artificial debt that doesn't exist. We've heard cases where a young person is traveling with the drugs from one part of the country to another, and then the gang rob them, make it look like it's someone else, and then they say, you've lost £10,000 worth of drugs, and you have to now work that off. If these kids mess up in any way, if they want to get out, they're immediately threatened.
One of the dealers actually stabbed me. Because I got robbed.
So hang on, you got robbed and you went back and you said, I haven't got the drugs, so he stabbed you. What, to punish you?
Yeah.
They can be beaten up. We've heard cases where young kids go and they come back and they've got frostbites on their feet, they're starving, they're dirty, they've been gone for several weeks, no one knows what's happened to them. But once they start to open up, you hear about the fact that they've heard women being raped, they've been beaten up by addicts themselves. That, yeah, it's extreme levels of violence that's really, really horrifying.
This is my reality, you know? Seeing people die, seeing people get shot, seeing people get stabbed, seeing pregnant women smoke crap, that's my reality.
Yeah.
Normal. This is just normal to me. Don't affect me, it's nothing. If they're coming to get me, they better kill me. But if they don't kill me, I'm coming back to kill them.
You've got a knife right there.
Yeah, no, this is nothing, man. This is what I would give to the people when the little kids when they go out from
me. When these County Lions gangs set up in the towns, what's their relationship like with established dealers who are already, you know, providing drugs for that area?
One common thing is they bring them into the fold. They say, work with us, we've got much stronger drugs, or we've got access to a lot more drugs, we can do a much bigger operation. So they get several dealers in. Other times they can be really, really violent. They say, this is our area now. If we see you doing any sort of drug dealing, we'll, yeah, get rid of you.
And sort of take their customer base.
Yeah,
and
the key is the customer base. The key is the numbers on the line. That is where all of the money is. So everyone else is disposable, including the young people, the young adults and the children. But who is the numbers on that line is where all the money is. So you see dealers go through extraordinary lengths to protect that phone line.
Do we know what sort of scale this County Lines process is taking place on across the country? Like, how big are these gangs? Do we know how many of them there are?
We don't know how many gangs, but we do know there's at least 2,000 phone lines that are connected with County Lines. If we think that each line can bring a profit of about £800,000, this is an industry that is worth hundreds of millions of pounds.
The children who are involved in these cases, if they're caught, I mean, are they treated by the police's victims or as criminals?
It really depends on the case and really depends on what they've done. It's a lot more difficult if they've been violent, if they've been found to have a great deal of drugs. And obviously, we can't assume everybody that's involved in this doesn't in some way want to do it themselves. But I think what makes County Lines quite different from your regular drug dealing is the fact that, yeah, this is where modern slavery is at play. The CPS should be treating them as victims of human trafficking or modern slavery, because a lot of the time, no 15, 16, 17-year-old can say they've done this on their own will, gone to somewhere they've never been to before to sell drugs. The local police forces, as well as national police chiefs, have started to say, you know, if they found a drug dealer up higher end in the food chain, they're no longer going to be prosecuted as a drug dealer. A lot of the times, they're now going to be prosecuted as child traffickers as well.
Okay, so today is very significant. It's a landmark in terms of use of the modern slavery legislation. As police, we will go after those leaders, not only for the drugs, not only for the violence, but also for exploiting young people.
You've painted this picture of a typical County Lines case, of what feels like quite a messy, chaotic system. A gang trafficking children, sometimes hundreds of miles, to work on a drug production line in the home of a vulnerable adult. And all of this is underpinned by threats and violence. But you've discovered that some gangs are really evolving their tactics. What have you found?
So I was speaking to Carly Thomas, who's a senior caseworker at St. Giles Trust. She's been supporting young people caught up with County Lines over the last few years. She went to a southeast town and she said, you know, herself, she was really quite taken back at the fact that there didn't really seem to be any County Lines operations going on. She was supporting about 22 boys aged between the age of 12 to 17, who she was told, maybe there's something going on here, but they were all really close friends. They were all really happy. They just didn't show any obvious signs of exploitation or abuse. You know, she even like was called back to her head office to be like, I don't think there's anything here. I'm not sure there's much we can do here. And she, yeah, she really wondered if she was in the wrong spot. And then that's when slowly, you know, she was winning the confidence and trust of those boys. Then they started to disclose. And what they disclosed really shocked her and me as well.
What kind of things were they telling her?
It's just a radically different picture to the one I've just painted. So rather than addicts and needles and these really horrible apartments or houses, these young people were working in quite clean, nice Airbnbs. They were told to come in at 9 a.m. She said that they were racing to get there and they would be assigned shifts and that, you know, certain roles. And it was essentially a factory line within this Airbnb. They were all involved in the cutting and putting together of the drugs in some way. And they got an hour for lunch. During that lunch break, they'd be given McDonald's, they'd be allowed to play video games. Once the lunch break was over, there'd be roles in people going out to do the selling of the drugs. The day finished around 4 p.m. They were also being encouraged to work well. You know, that came with certain bonuses, that if you were able to come and bring friends, that also came with certain perks. Once the lease was over in that Airbnb, the boys would clear up, they would be given bleach, they would just bleach down all the work that they were doing, and then they'd move on to the next Airbnb, leaving no trace, and each one would be given £250 for that day's work. Something that was really interesting about this was the boys were being recruited locally, so they didn't really have the same issue of finding a kid in London and getting them down to the southeast coast.
And I suppose the advantage of using local kids in this operation is you don't have the issue of them looking different.
Definitely. Some kids have been sent to areas where the local population is 99.8% white. So when you have, you know, a black kid or an Asian kid from Liverpool or London, they tend to stand out on that train and they're definitely going to stand out in the local area. The boys being recruited locally, they're going to blend in. They're well known to the local area. So it doesn't really spark any suspicions.
How were the kids responding to this system?
They were really happy. They had a really strong work ethic. They were turning up on time. They felt like they were doing genuine risk-free work. And that was really, really worrying for her. Carly, when she kind of got a bit of a taster of what was happening, her first thought was, oh my God, how the hell am I going to get them out of this?
I can imagine if you're a kid who's like 15, 16 and someone comes along and says, I'm going to pay you loads of money, I'm going to give you free McDonald's and, you know, potentially drugs as well if you're using cannabis. Mm. This is a really hard thing to kind of pass up.
Oh, definitely. So hard to walk away from if the other options are unemployment or you might not be going to school.
And do we have any idea if this seemingly new pattern of operating is being used quite widely?
So I haven't seen any other examples of this very specific Airbnb operation, but we are seeing gangs becoming a bit smarter about the things that tip off the authorities, because once that happens, your line gets shut down and you lose a great deal of money. So we've seen gangs around London where they figured out the number of absences that will trigger a response from the local authority. And by that, I mean, they know, for example, if a kid's been absent for 5 days in school, the school's going to get involved, the social workers are going to get involved, and they're going to start asking questions. So they're going to make sure the kids are out of school less than that. They've also got kids working around the school day, selling drugs or doing a bit of the drug selling process during lunches, before school, after school. And those who are in PRUs, like I said before, some of them are only there for 2 hours, so they can actually go to the southeast and back and not be noticed at all.
Why do you think it's developed this way? Why have the gangs developed this technique?
Competition, essentially. They want to be able to survive and be as sustainable as possible. Violence is a problem, essentially. So if you continue operating in a way that's extremely violent, the authorities will get involved at some stage. But if you want to be a profitable business that's really, really sustainable, then you need to start professionalizing. You know, we did see this in America. I read a really interesting paper that showed how gangs moved away from what we know them to be, that really violent force, towards a much more profitable professional service to sell drugs. And the reason why we've got gangs who are telling kids, if you bring another kid, we'll give you £200. If you work really well, we'll give you a bonus, is because there are other gangs setting up county lines who are interested in doing a similar operation.
It's like The Wire.
It really is. Season 3 or 4 of The Wire, essentially.
It seems on the surface, and this is a difficult thing to say in a way, that for the kids that are involved in this different operation, that things are a bit better for them and they, as you described it, seem happy. Mm. But ultimately, this feels like a more complex form of grooming that is impossible in many ways for them to get out of.
Oh, definitely. You know, some of the kids will tell Carly, well, I don't see what the problem is. I'm clean, I've got money, I'm not being abused. But they are, because what you tend to forget is these are children. They should be in schools. They should be worrying about their GCSE or why this person hasn't texted them back and what their university options are, not how I'm going to cut up this crack cocaine. That's not a world they should be in at all. And what's interesting, in even though that operation seemed nice, the way some of them got involved in that operation was still that similar thing that I told you about. They were told they had a drug debt, or they were pressured, or they were groomed. They were made to think these people were really nice and cared for them, but they don't. You know, if any of these kids got arrested, that drug dealer isn't going to be in court to make sure that they're okay. They're really disposable to them. Their bottom line is profit. And that's, I guess, what really Carly had to get through to them.
And with gangs professionalising and seemingly satisfying a need for people in these communities who want drugs, and using kids who are expendable, you know, if they leave, they can be replaced, it seems, relatively easily. It feels like it will be nationally very difficult to break the cycle of the County Lines network.
The biggest worry for Carly and the local authorities was that these tactics are meant to keep kids underground. You know, if a kid is in a cuckoo house and he sees someone else being beaten up, or he himself is being beaten up, he's far more likely to go to the authorities and say, this has happened to me, because he'll be scared. He's not going to want to go back there the next day. But these kids in Airbnbs, who, they're not going to go to the police and say, I'm having a good time and I'm getting money for it. I don't know how you break that, but yeah, it's a huge struggle.
Amna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In response to this story, Airbnb gave us this statement.
We have zero tolerance for inappropriate or illegal activity and permanently remove bad actors from our platform. We proactively reach out to relevant organisations on how we can work better together, including government and law enforcement agencies. Amna Modin's reporting is part of a Guardian series called Behind the Lines, which is looking at the scale and consequences of the county lines phenomenon. You can read it all at theguardian.com. Coming up, can Labour's new Brexit policy please both Leave and Remain voters? Now, ahead of Labour's party conference this weekend, Jeremy Corbyn has said he will put the final decision on Brexit back to the people if his party wins an election, with a choice to leave with a deal or remain in the EU.
I think the important thing is to put the offer before the people and they will make the choice and I will deliver it.
Guardian columnist Owen Jones argues that to succeed, Labour has to unite leavers and remainers.
So Labour have effectively adopted the People's Vote campaign, and its argument was that any deal negotiated with the European Union should be subject to a confirmatory referendum in which the alternative was Remain. So if Labour were to win a majority in the next general election, then Labour would negotiate a deal which it would regard as the least destructive of the European Union that protected its red lines, so on workers' rights, on the economy, for example, and on the Irish border, and it would put that on the ballot paper, and the alternative would be Remain. The party would allow, in practice, Labour politicians and Labour members to campaign for the position that they prefer. Now, in practice, of course, that means virtually all Labour MPs and the vast majority of the Labour membership who are pro-Remain will campaign on that side. What's been left unclear is whether Jeremy Corbyn would basically stay out of the referendum campaign. His argument is that his job is to deliver whatever the British people vote for. And this is often compared to Harold Wilson in 1975, who, although he did back against Labour Party policy Britain's entry into the common market, he largely took a backseat role. And the argument that is being put forward is, we're a divided nation, the Prime Minister should be a unifying figure and just deliver the result people vote for. I think the reaction's been interesting because I think a lot of people within the Corbyn camp kind of think, what on earth do we have to do to satisfy you people? Because effectively, Labour Party policy has now delivered exactly what Remainers were asking for a very long time. All those Remainers who believed that Brexit is something which is very bad for the nation and needs to be resisted, which is to have another referendum with Remain on the ballot paper. Personally, I was relieved by Labour's shift in position. I was one of those after the referendum who thought, well, it sucks we lost, but it was a pretty close result, so let's leave with a close deal, try and heal the nation and get back to the issues that matter. And I took the view after the European elections, in which supporters of Brexit flocked to the Brexit Party and supporters of Remain flocked to the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, that that position was no longer tenable, that there wasn't the middle ground on Brexit that people like me supported. I think that's sad because trying to escape this infernal, horrendous debate is a bit of a nightmare when you care about other issues like the NHS or poverty or housing or foreign policy or any of the issues that loom large. But what you want and the reality of where people are at are often two very different things. And therefore, if Labour want a chance at winning the next election, if they want to mobilise and enthuse their membership and stop people who want a Labour government which tackles the injustices that led to Brexit, flocking instead to the Liberal Democrats, dividing the vote and handing Boris Johnson a no-deal, hard-right Tory majority, that there was no choice, that Labour has to back a referendum Remain on the ballot paper, but equally has to say to Leave voters, we don't hold you in contempt and we will have a deal negotiated for you as well, and then try and, you know, resolve the issue. But the danger is, the Lib Dems and others will now keep shifting the goalposts and nothing will ever be good enough. And the danger of being stuck with a election which focuses just on this narrow issue rather than the other issues that we should be talking about as a nation.
That was Owen Jones. My thanks to him and to Amna Modin. Today's episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.